Hi everyone, I'm Rebecca Hewitt, the Executive Director of the SDC Foundation. Thanks for being here this afternoon for our second roundtable conversation about artistic leadership. Last month, we held our first roundtable with Jacob Padrone, Stephanie Ibarra, Hannah Sharif, Robert Barry Fleming, and Nataki Garrett. The amazing Sheldon Epps, who you'll hear from in just a moment, moderated that conversation. If you missed it, the audio recording is available on the SDCF website. From the homepage menu, click on Conversations, and that will take you to our podcast series. So homepage menu, Conversations, and you'll find the podcast series there. The recording of today's roundtable will be there also in a few days. Okay. I'm thrilled to introduce our moderator for this series, an invaluable SDCF trustee, Artistic Director Emeritus of the Pasadena Playhouse, and just recently named Senior Artistic Advisor of Ford Theater in Washington, D.C., Mr. Sheldon Epps. Sheldon.
Thank you, Rebecca. Thanks very much. Thank you, everyone who's joining us today. Great to have you here. I don't have to say turn off your cell phones. But I do have to advise everybody that we're having all kind of weather conditions for my guests and for me today, between heat and fires and cell tower trauma. So forgive us if I disappear for a while, if someone disappears and comes back. It might be a little bumpy on the virtual road today. But we're very glad you're here. Rebecca and Danny, thank you so much for helping to set this up. We've been taking this opportunity over the summer in the midst of many challenges going on in our country and in our theater to talk to artistic leaders, and in this case, what I'd like to call new or newish artistic leaders, people who have not been at their theaters for very long, though some of them, as with one of our guests today, may have been an artistic director over many, many years. So joining me today are Melia Bensusan, who's from Hartford Stage Company, Tim Bond, who's at Theater Works in Northern California, David Ivers from South Coast Rep, Rob Melrose from the Alley Theater in Houston, and Sarah Rasmussen from MacArthur Theater Company in Princeton. Hi, everybody. Great to have you here. So as most of you know, I was an artistic director for 20 years at Pasadena Playhouse with all of the joys, frustrations, highs, lows, laughter, tears, and everything else that that encompasses. And I always like to ask first about everybody's road to artistic leadership, how you wound up as artistic leaders of a theater company. Not so much in terms of credits and all of that, but just what were the things that led you to want the jobs and to take the jobs? And Tim, I think I'll start with you since you've been in and out of it for so many years.
Sure. Well, thanks, Sheldon. It's really great to see you and to see everyone here. I have been an artistic director. This is now my fourth post. If I go all the way back to a small Black community theater that I was running in Seattle back in the 80s. And coming back again now was something that I sort of felt in my heart I might want to do when I left Syracuse Stage 4 years ago, and I tried the academic route and ended up at University of Washington, where I had gotten my graduate degree and went back, became a full professor, and was teaching there and running the professional acting training program. And I have always said since I was in high school in Sacramento many years ago that if I ever ended up somewhere different than Seattle, it might be the Bay Area. And the opportunity arose to look into Theater Works here in Silicon Valley. And 50-year founder Robert Kelly was stepping down. And I started to look more deeply into their programming and what they had been doing and where they said they wanted to go. And it felt like the right fit. And I also, I have to say, politically, what's going on in the world made me feel like I didn't want to just talk about it and teach it in school. I really needed to be back in community and somewhere where I could really try to make a difference societally, not just in a small group setting. And so artistic directorship grabbed me again. Here I am.
Great. That's great. Let's jump to the other side of the scale with somebody who just took on their position almost yesterday. Sarah, you're the, as I just said a few minutes ago, you were the newbie of the group because you literally just started this month. Yes,
I did. Yes, it's my 17th day of work. We're still in the phase, right? We know the day of work by the number.
You know where you are, actually.
I do. I don't know. I usually don't know what day of the week it is, but I am aware of where I am. This is my second formal artistic director job, but I actually started my first theater company as a kid, so it's sort of my third. I started directing plays and running a tiny neighborhood company in Sisseton, South Dakota, which is a small town in very rural South Dakota. As a teenage girl, my mom was an English teacher. Long story short, we went to the Guthrie, we stood in rush lines, and I saw the work of Garland Wright as a teenage girl and really fell in love with it. And fairly instantly fell in love with the idea of directing and the very visual medium of the way Garland used the stage, and then found myself in a conundrum that I was madly in love with directing and the theater, and was living in a town where there was no live performing arts for hundreds of miles in any direction. So I thought, how hard could it be? I'll start directing and I'll start a theater company. So I still really hearken back to that, because as a kid, I really felt like plays are a gift for a community. They are a place to have a conversation with the community. They are a place to find joy and to make meaning and to find a little more beauty in a world that could use more of that. And I still feel the same way decades later.
Thank you, Sarah. Let me jump to you, David. How about you and your road to South Coast?
Thank you. Yeah, good to see you all, truly. And Sheldon, thanks for moderating this. It's wonderful to be with you. So this is my third post, also maybe two and a half, but maybe also four, in college as an acting student in Ashland, Oregon, at Southern Oregon, what was Southern Oregon State College. I and my cohorts started a summer theater because there was no work for those of us staying in town in the summer. I worked at a gas station, and we formed a company called Innovative Artist Theater Company that was made up of the BFA acting students in Ashland. And while OSF was selling tickets, we were begging people to come to a storefront on the second floor of Main Street and see P.S. Your Cat Is Dead. So that, if you remember that chestnut, and that began this strange journey where in the back of my head, I loved being in the curious and wonderful collaboration about ideas and how artists could be at the center of ideas for leadership. But I went off and pursued my career as an actor, and I went to Minneapolis, the Guthrie and the MFA program that was at the University of Minnesota, further curious about leadership. And then my career took off, oddly, maybe, as an actor. And so I spent my time really connected to major regional theaters as a resident actor. First with the Utah Shakespeare Festival, which I ended up going from intern to artistic director over, 21 seasons. And so I learned about the leadership side and the wonderment and curious pull about being an artistic director from being steeped inside the process on the other side of the table. And that led to my appointment in a dual role at Utah, and then to being pulled over to Arizona Theater Company briefly. And from there, I think in part due to the work and the curiosity I still have around process in the room and how that engages with what's outside the room, community. I'm a South Coast rep. I should say I had a 10-year stint with the Denver Center in there too, as one of their associate artists and resident actors, and did 40 some odd plays there at the Denver Center. And, you know, I also have not really looked back, because I think all of the journey inside of plays as an actor and director was all with the lens of curiosity about how to orchestrate the larger picture as a leader based on, wait a second, I don't have hot water in the backstage. Damn it, when I lead, we're going to have it. and so here we are, back where I grew up in Southern California.
Great. Thanks, David. Melia, let's go to you.
Hi.
Talk about that journey to where you are now.
The long road. these are great stories. I suppose if we're going to sort of what, you know, what made us directors, I didn't do P.S. Your Cat is Dead. I grew up in Mexico City, attending a Zionist yeshiva. And as part of, in order to avoid the shorthand class that all seventh grade girls were supposed to take, I sat in shorthand and I wrote a stage version in Spanish of The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. I mention this because I had no idea that it was a Christian allegory in any way, shape, or form until I got to college. So I think my text analysis has grown over the years. In terms of becoming a director, I had really thought that first I'd have to be a famous actor and then they'd let me direct plays. I didn't know about any women who directed. So when I first came to the United States, I sort of assumed the road was to be an actor and then eventually they'd let you to direct. They would let me direct. In college, I wasn't being cast very much, or as much as I wanted. And so I started directing through the student theater and realized that was really what I wanted to do. A few years later, when I first started working in regional theaters, I realized how much what I really wanted to do was run a theater. I don't know how many of you, if any of you know Eddie Gilbert, who ran Pittsburgh Public for a long time. I directed his wife, and he said to me at one point, have you thought about being an artistic director? And he quoted, I think it's Samuel Johnson, that you can define people whether they're hosts or guests, and it's important to know which you are. And I felt very much like a host. I don't cook, so not the cooking part of hosting, but in terms of welcoming and inviting and connecting people and celebrating people's work and building a larger aesthetic, that just always appealed to me. The road here was, I guess, in some ways non-traditional, although I don't know what a traditional road is. I know how long ago it was. I had very young children, so about 20 years ago. I was shortlisted for a couple of different theaters and was actually offered a theater to run, and it just wasn't good timing in terms of my partner's work and where I was as a parent, where my brain was. So it was interesting. For me, this has been a very, very moving journey because I passed on several opportunities and to be honest, had thought, well, the running of a theater, that ship has sailed. I fell in love with teaching, became a department chair, and ran a theater program. And that, you know, Tim, as you were saying, right? I mean, running a theater program allowed me to feel like I was hosting and mentoring and nurturing, and I did love all of that. And then a year ago, or 18 months ago, I took over Hartford Stage a year ago after basically having freelanced for, you know, many, many, many years. When I first heard from the search firm for Hartford, to be perfectly honest, I thought there is no fucking way I'm going to get this job. And I said to a few friends, some of you who might actually be online here, I said, yeah, no freaking way. but how fun to be back in those conversations. I've actually always loved talking to boards. I really had enjoyed the interview process, oddly enough, when I first went through all of this many years ago. So I thought, well, this will be fun if I get anywhere in this search. And the excitement about being a civic leader to really change a city, Hartford was just, I mean, Hartford's broke, right? Hartford's broke and it's 47% Latinx. So I get to walk in and talk about doing bilingual work and just changing the feel of what that building is downtown and how the building serves that city. It just was so exciting to think, oh, I really have a shot at this at this point. And I get to go back and have an impact larger than my own work. I think that for me has been, even at this horrible, horrible time. It's really, really a bad time, right? I'm just, as I said to some of you right before we started, it's dark days, but I'm very grateful to be in this position actually, even at this time, because I feel like we can be institutional beacons and places that support other artists and our regions. So, sorry, that was maybe a very long version, but I want to say it's okay to have stopgaps and reinvent your life and be in different places in different stages of your life. That for me is really worthy of celebration.
And we celebrate it.
Thank you, Sheldon. You make everything seem okay. And I'm very grateful to you for that.
You're welcome. You're welcome. Rob, I'm going to tell you about my connection, my specific connection to the alley in a moment. But tell us first how you made the road and landed there.
Yeah. Well, interestingly enough, I'm going to be the third person to talk about the Guthrie, which was important in my life. My high school drama teacher, Tom Hagg, had been a company member at the Guthrie, and he taught me, and he was super influential on my life and was the best man at my wedding. But in high school, I kind of thought of theater as fun, and I thought I was going to do something serious with my life. And it wasn't until French class, when I read No Exit, that I realized, oh, whoa, theater can really explore some amazing ideas. And that working on that play kind of shifted my sense of theater as something that's just fun and it's just, you know, a lark and entertaining, to something that is really powerful. And I grew up going to Garland Wright's Guthrie Theater and was really moved and influenced by that work. I think of like one summer when, you know, one day you could see Nagamandala, which was an Indian play. You could see Too Clever by Half by Ostrovsky, which he had done in this kind of Russian constructivist way. And then the next night you could come and see Dominique Seurat directing Triumph of Love with some of the Junlun actors. And just, you know, 3 days, you could see three completely different ideas of what theater can be, and actors who I just thought were magicians and you know, kind of put on a pedestal. And I was so fortunate later in life to be invited by Joe Dowling, who was also an influence on me, to have me direct Sally Wingert and Richard Ohms in Happy Days. And I had grown up watching them on stage, and that was just such a satisfying experience for me, because I just believed so much in that company of actors, and working with them was amazing. I studied theater in undergrad and grad school, and then I got a Fox grant. For a time, the Fox grant was open to directors, and I got one during that time, and my wife and I wound up being in Europe. We wound up going to 13 different countries, seeing, it was specifically look at productions of Shakespeare in translation in France, Germany, and Italy. But by the time we were done, we'd gone to 13 different countries and spent a year there, and just saw some really amazing work, really great directors, kind of ripping apart the classics, some, you know, in new ways, doing some really interesting experimental work. And so I came back from that. That was my first year after grad school, just really charged with kind of the kind of work I wanted to do. And I moved to San Francisco kind of with the idea that I wanted to be a freelance director. I had a lot of plays I wanted to direct. And my first year being a freelance director, I wasn't really doing the kind of stuff I was dreaming about. So kind of by accident, I just wound up starting my own theater company. Paige and I started, founded the Cutting Ball Theater, and you know, very shoestring at the start, very low budget, but I was really doing the work that was important to me and the work that I wanted to see in the world. And then our space wound up being in the Tenderloin of San Francisco, which is one of the most diverse neighborhoods in the world. There are 75 different languages spoken there. And as time went on, you know, the work that I was so excited about seeing in, you know, seeing it, you know, at the Guthrie, at in Europe, started to meld with wanting to speak to this community, wanting to speak to this neighborhood. And so more and more, we started doing plays that were, you know, inviting the neighborhood in, reflecting the neighborhood. And that both of those kind of strains kind of started to enter my freelance work around the country. And then when the opportunity came to run the Alley Theater, my first day in Houston, I'd watched the Anthony Bourdain piece on Houston, which he goes into a different community. He goes into the Indian community, he goes into the Vietnamese community, the Black community, and the Latinx community, and talks about the food, talks about the culture. And Anthony Bourdain kind of won me over right then and there. But then my first day was there was a celebration of the theater district, and the opera, the Alley, the symphony, the ballet, they're all right in the same neighborhood. And I just felt like, oh my God, Houston is such an amazing city. And this theater district is fabulous, and the Alley is fabulous. So I just fell in love right away and knew that's where I wanted to be. And so I've had a fabulous first year up in just right until March. It couldn't have been better, but there you are.
Thanks, Rob. I have connections in one way or another to all of your theaters and been to all of your theaters. But Rob, I want to tell you about my special connection to the Alley. I actually got a job as an actor, David, at the Alley before I graduated in March of my senior year, and went to the Alley to do Jacques Brel Is Alive and Well and Living in Paris. And this was during the last couple of years that Nina was both artistic director and still alive. And Nina Vance, who really was one of the people to start the regional theater movement, was this great combination of incredible grand dame and down-low Southern girl. And Nina used to come into my tiny little dressing room half hour, and she literally would hoist herself up on the sink because there was no place else to sit in the dressing room. She would sit in the sink and she would tell me all of these great stories about founding the regional theater movement. Oh. Of working with Gordon Davidson and Zelda Fitchandler and all of those people to actually create the movement which gave us all our careers and our jobs. And she would just be both inspirational and moving and incredibly, incredibly funny about the beginning of the movement. Just wonderful stories. So I always feel very close to the Alley Theater.
I'm so jealous of those experiences. I hear stories about her, and I've read about, I of course I was 10 when she passed away, so there was no chance of us meeting. But her legend is strong in those walls in that building. So it's great to hear someone who's actually met her and knew her.
Yeah, every outrageous story you've ever heard is true. I promise you that.
I love it.
So Melia brought it up. These are indeed challenging times. One might say dark times, but tough times for American theater, tough times for our country, in fact. You are all somewhere between Sarah's 17 days and about 3 years at your theater, I think is the most anybody on this call is. So what's it been like to
be 34 days for me.
34 days. Twice as long as Sarah, right?
Twice as long as me.
You're the old pro here at 34 days. Yeah. That's so right. I'll start with you, Sarah. What's it like just as you're hitting the road to be confounded by the pandemic and all of the issues that has brought on? And in fact, in your case, Sarah and I suspect him to have never actually even met your audience. Yes.
I feel very fortunate that I got to spend a lot of in-person time in the process in person here, because you're right, it's a lot of time on Zoom right now for all of us. I think, yes, it's an incredibly, incredibly challenging time. I am deeply grateful for managing directors and board chairs and board members and staffs that are around the country doing incredible work. And I feel incredibly lucky to be walking into an organization that that has that kind of leadership at the helm in terms of our managing director and our board leadership. It feels oftentimes like I have two brains going at any given time, because I'm both listening to what it was and also in the moment trying to rethink and retool what it should be interim, and also McCarter 2.0 as we come back. So it's a lot of plates spinning all at once in my mind. But I also think that there's incredible opportunity in this time too. I think I would not wish a global pandemic on any planet, but the fact that it's coming at a time when McCarter is shifting from 30 years of one leader to a new vision, that we are building on that legacy. And we're very much talking about systems and change and what we wanted to do moving forward, to be as innovative and sustainable as possible. I think there is opportunity in these times to listen, to look at our deeper systems of how we create work, how we welcome people, how people feel a sense of belonging in our organization. And I think that strategic planning is essential. When I was an artistic director in Minneapolis, I took over for a founder who'd been there for 25 years. And I did all the same work, strategic planning, listening, all of that, while I was also inheriting a season and choosing a season and doing all of that. So having done this before, it's different, but having transitioned into a position where there was a leader for many decades before me, I find that this time is also, I'm also optimistic, right? I think that there's a gift in this time in terms of, we know as a country, we know as an industry, we can't go back to the way it was before. And so how do we want to change? Many people told me in my first artistic director job, it's like trying to fix the plane while it's flying. And what I've been telling our staff now is, well, the planes are on the ground. So how do we want to fix them in this time so they fly in ways that we'd like to see them soar moving forward?
Tim, how about you? Since you've been there twice as long as Sarah, what do you?
Absolutely, you twice as long. Yeah, old hat to me.
You should have all the answers already.
Oh wow, it's pretty wild. I mean, having run three other theaters before certainly helps in the sense that I understand a lot of how theaters work. Taking over a theater that has been run by only one founder for 50 years, which is an extraordinary tenure in the American theater. And this theater grew from a very small little theater for youth project into all the variations building up to become a Lort B Theater and having just won the Tony Award last year for regional theaters. So, and they were very well prepared for transition. I mean, they really spent 3 years working to be prepared for whoever next was coming. I don't think they knew that was going to be me, but they never do. And then, you know, with I got here about a month after COVID had hit physically, but not able to physically be with anyone this whole time. So, and I'm a very kinetic person. I am a molecule person. I like want to be in the room with you, feel those molecules, feel them bounce off each other, feel that organic thing and find some synergy and see where we're going. And so this Zoom thing is not working for me and it's hard. But I'll say that because they had done so much work in preparation, I think people's minds and hearts were open and ready for change. No one expected this, but we are using this time to really reassess the organization, where we want to go. And with everything that's going on socially and politically in the world, with Black Lives Matter, with racial justice work, there's a real deep look at how we are thinking about some of the systemic issues that are embedded in this theater and in our society. And having time because of the pause that we are in is actually useful for us. And we're trying to take advantage of that and looking at a lot of digital programming. So I think the metaphors are a set of building an airplane while you're flying it in the air already is true. And we're sort of grounded, but we're still flowing down a river or something. I don't know what the other metaphor is that we're in, but we're still moving. And the digital content is sort of, we're learning that while we're in the middle of making it. So it's like making a new production company at the same time as we're doing a strategic plan, at the same time as they're getting used to the new guy, but they can't really meet the new guy. I have not met my audience, really. I saw a few shows when I was interviewing, thank goodness, and got a feeling for the vibe there and met a few people in the lobby, which was very nice. But it's sort of like I got shot out of a cannon or maybe in like an astronaut, and I'm up in space and I feel like I'm in cryovac, like I'm in suspended animation, waiting to land on who knows what new planet when we get there. But while we're traveling, we're figuring out what we want it to look like when we get there and how we're going to go at it when we land. I can't wait till we do.
Melly, if you want to talk about that a bit?
Sure. This is great. This
challenges is great. At the moment.
Having been the one who talked about how dark these days are, and yes. I have to say I made the mistake of starting the day by reading the newspaper, even though I was going to avoid the Republican convention. So I'm just putting out there that that's part of my darkness. For me, so I've been at Hartford Stage for 1 year. I was just, the good part about it was that I very quickly found community partners and had already made some changes culturally, but we were just kind of really revving up. Rob was there for my opening show, which was Quijote Nuevo, which then went to Huntington in the Alley. So I had Octavio Solis and KJ Sanchez there and a great design team. And we had a big party. I mean, we had fiestas, we had free food, we had booze. We were like, come hang out with us. Be a part of this community for Christmas Carol. We had a Spanish reading of Christmas Carol and we had a posada and working with, we started a babysitting program for matinees. I mean, I was just like, we are doing this, you know, it was so cool. And then I had to lay off 75 or 80% of my staff. So that sucked, right? So right when I'm getting momentum with this brilliant staff who had given their, given in some cases 20 years, 30 years to Hartford Stage, I'm the new person who comes in and says, this theater was running in a deficit. We're already, we were in financial trouble before COVID, and then we had to cancel 2.5 shows. So I love the airplane analogy. I think we are using this time to increase our bilingual work. We're trying to make, I love this, it's absolutely right what Tim, what you're saying, we're trying to figure out how the hell to produce on these machines. I hate it. I hate Zoom theater. I'm trying really hard. And I really admire all of you out there who are making cool things. And I read about you and I'm like, oh, you're so cool. I just need a rehearsal room and people. So that's a challenge. But the community piece, this is an opportunity. Oddly, and we're collaborating with the big community college on our corner and bringing that population more, and there is more access. I was doing weekly kind of get-togethers on the Hartford Stage platform, Zoom, just doing kind of a come talk about theater with different guests. Those were weekly for a while. We've switched to monthly because a weekly talk show is really exhausting. I don't, especially with a really limited staff. But I agree that there's an opportunity here. The hard part was laying people off and really gifted, talented artists who now are struggling to make a living. So and that's on all of us in this industry. I know probably a lot of you watching are freelancers and in the same, this is really a difficult moment. Sheldon and I are both on the SDC executive board, so we've had the privilege of those conversations as well. The plus of it is that we do have an opportunity to rethink the organization, the Black Lives Matter, We See You White American Theater documents, the EDI training we're able to do with the core staff that's left. And also to try to envision, Sarah, as you said, it's what is Hartford Stage 2.0. I think all our theaters, right, we're gonna have to rescale. We're gonna have to think about what our communities need. We're all able to talk about how important our communities are to us, but the scale of our work and who is in our building and how that reflects our community or doesn't, and where the priorities are institutionally. I mean, that part is exciting to think about. And I am optimistic about that and about coming through this. So there's the good and the bad of this time. I think someone on my board, and to echo Sarah, I mean, I just cannot say enough good about my managing director. I mean, if I didn't have her as a partner, we started together, Cynthia Ryder, just an amazing, amazing soul and good mind, came from OSF to us, but how to work within a fiscally responsible model now, and how to bring in the right folks, but while still honoring what someone on my board said was the secret sauce of Hartford Stage, which was a lot of the staff that we had to let go of. So trying to hold those two ideas, right? We're gonna reinvent, we're gonna come through, but I have all those folks in mind who have given so much to make Hartford Stage what it was, who aren't with us on this journey, and them. And I think that's important to hold on to as well.
Great. That's great, Melia. Thank you for that. Rob, you said you've been there about a year. Can you talk about, you know, putting the brakes on after a year? And specifically, I wanted to ask, the Alley still has a resident company, yes?
Yes, yes.
How are you dealing with that in terms of this stoppage and important
well,
things
I'll,
like
that? I'll start there. About a month, you know, the resident acting company are actually mentioned in our mission, you know, so they are central to the Alley Theater. And they were not, you know, like a lot of, unlike every resident acting company in Europe, but like most resident acting companies in the United States, they weren't full-time employees of the theater. They were hired, you know, for the shows that they were doing, but not, you know, they had gaps, right? And I worked with Dean, my wonderful general manager, and Brandon Kahn, really great. Brandon Kahn's the general manager, Dean's the managing director. We worked together to make all of the actors full-time employees of the theater. That took effect like a month before COVID hit. So they have been with us this entire time, these eight actors. And that's been a real strength because we've done, you know, workshops online. We've kept our work moving forward. And of course, it's terrible not to be on stage, but it doesn't feel like the art has stopped for us, and that's been really important. And, you know, ethically, I feel like we're protecting our actors, you know, which I think, you know, these theaters have these, you know, long histories, and they were built by the hard work of actors. And so the actors should be protected. So that's been a great thing. As far as, you know, my time at the Alley and then the stop, it was so blissful up until March 14th. I just loved being there. I loved the work we were doing. We did, as Amelia said, we did Kyoto Nuevo together. We did Viet Gone. Of course, the fun about doing these plays in Houston is the audiences really, really show up from these communities, and you really feel that you're serving all of Houston, which is great. We also did, you know, great productions of 1984, and which had more relevance today than, you know, than ever, and Winter's Tale. So I was having just a great time, and of course we were bringing more diversity to our stages than the theater had in decades. What this stoppage has done, the opportunity here, is to do the deeper work with the staff, right? Our staff has been traumatized first with Hurricane Harvey, then with the leadership change, and the leadership change, my leadership style is very different from my predecessor, and you know, there's a lot of, you know, issues that are triggered from kind of this past that was more authoritarian and my way, which is hopefully more collaborative. And so kind of getting through those traumas is something that we actually have the time to do. And also, thanks to Black Lives Matter, thanks to We See You White American Theater. There's also a great document called The Living Document in Bay Area theaters have put together. There's a Houston group that has kind of put a 40% call. So there's a lot of wisdom. We've also we had an affinity group with our employees of color to kind of look at all the wisdom that's out there. Amelia and I are on a phone call. I'll give a shout out to Nataki, who says something really wonderful about the We See You document. She says, you know, every demand represents a lived experience by an artist. And so it's not just a abstract demand. It's often a fight that somebody fought at their theater and won. All credit to Nataki, she's the one who said it. But it's true, and so, you know, we at the Alley are looking through this document, and you know, we've broken it up into a spreadsheet, and of course we're working with a wonderful EDI consultant. Her name's Alison Park from Blink Consulting, to doing anti-racism work with the whole theater. And while we're taking all this wisdom in, you know, Alison has a great point. She says, you know, you can't, you know, someone else's demands can't be your EDI strategy. You've got to take all that in, but then you've got to figure out who you want to be and how you're going to meet these demands with your city, with your employees, with your theater, and really making sure that the entire organization owns it and owns who they want to be and how we're going to get there. And that work has been really exciting. And just like Sarah says, it probably couldn't have happened while the plane was in the air. So that work is happening at the Alley, and it's something that I'm very enthusiastic about and proud of.
That's great. Thanks, Rob. David, you're sort of the OG artistic director here of the group, in that you've been at your theater a little bit longer. And from my observation, things were going incredibly well and doing fine work and going in some different directions than previous artistic directors, both immediate and the founding directors. Yes. So as you were just settling in to your success, how did it feel to suddenly be stopped in motion?
Well, thank you for the optimistic lens. I have yet to categorize anything I've done as success in my entire career, let alone last year. But I have been here in residence. It feels like maybe a bit longer, I'm sure, to everyone, but only actually 14 months. I had a long overlap because I wanted our boys to finish school in Arizona, similar to Rob, so that we didn't yank them out. And so I traveled back and forth quite a bit. And after this answer, I am going to have to run downstairs because I'm a single parent today, and my 8-year-old and 11-year-old are just finishing school, and I have to check in, and then I will run back up.
You're just getting a drink, David. We know that, but that's okay.
Oh, no. This is... look, you know, we were about 9 months in, 2/3 of the way into the season when the pandemic, you know, as all of our colleagues know, shut us down and had two shows in rehearsal, one in a final preview. And honestly, it's been hard. I've been a wreck. I've been depressed and sad. And there are days I've been elated because I felt like there's a focus. And that focus all of a sudden gives me 5 days of very focused, very clear work. And at the end of those 5 days, we get to a Friday and something happens on the weekend in the news. And you go back Monday and go, well, shit, that's not going to work. And you all know this. It's all a pivot. And Tim Bond, I love what all of you have said, but the idea of being a molecule, I'm going to steal. I'm the same way. I hover and buzz and want to be with people. I want to connect. I want to hear ideas and want to know how the institution is responding to something in real time, how the staff feels about a certain movement, the way we look at it, the way it happened last night compared to how it's going to look on the weekend. And so all that sort of stopped. And in the pivots, I feel like, okay, we've launched some stuff, right? But it's like running to stand still sometimes. And I've just found that really hard. And sometimes, you know, this week I was excited because yesterday I read two new plays. And that was the greatest victory to finally read two plays, because I've had a hard time reading plays because I can't put them in a context to produce them. And then I'm thinking to myself, is that just an excuse, you know, or is that really what's going on? So what we did and what we're continuing to do is to look back at the things that I said we were going to do when I had the great honor and privilege of being interviewed for this job. And I looked back and said, what did we do this season that was important toward the vision? And can we do that internally for our staff? So I know we're going to get to these questions. So yeah, we're in the middle of a consultancy period with a consultant company to look at our anti-racist or our racist practices and look at our implicit bias training and figure out how we can do that, all the while being incredibly thoughtful that I've got like 40 employees that aren't at the table for that now, that I want to be at the table. So I want the process to not just be about this moment. I want it to be integrated into the work that we think we all feel has been important prior to the great tragedies of recent events in this country, but ongoing for the health of the theater. And those people that we've lost because of this pandemic, I want to find a way to bring them into this conversation. So basically, I just said, look, we were moving into community. We were opening up our privileged campus in ways that we haven't before with American Mariachi, which is sort of a project I have been with for a while, and the way the community interacts with it. Thank you, every Shakespeare festival in the country, for the Green Show, because we just reconceived that idea as our lobbies become communities again, and they should be, and trying to break down those barriers. So now I don't have much of an appetite for the virtual world, but I am trying, and I'm asking questions about appetite of our staff, because otherwise, and I've said this on other panels, you know, it's like, otherwise we're just passing on work that our staff may not have an appetite for. So we just launched SCR Community, which is an entirely digital platform. And it's dedicated to the principle of putting money in artists, of California artists, in their pockets and telling stories about, by, or surrounded by, or told by artists from Southern California and artists that either have a legacy with South Coast Rep or new artists who will be contributing to it. We just launched it, and that finally felt really satisfying because it was lined up with things that we talked about we were going to do before. And we just launched another initiative called Outside SCR, which is going to partner us with a major cultural institution, and it's going to be hell to try to figure out the logistics to take SCR outside into the community and get us away from this notion that everybody has to come to us all the time. And so all of a sudden there's another moment that I hope doesn't run into a wall where I'm excited. And we have things to look at and plan. And we've greatly reduced our ambitions for next season. And as a person who wants to run and is very energetic, Paula Tumai, our managing director, who I am blessed every day, has the institutional knowledge that she has. I've said to her, are you still okay with me waiting? She said, oh my God, are you kidding? Please wait. Because what I'm trying to do right now is in the mode of being thoughtful and in the moment of curiosity about our staffing, what that's going to look like, appetite, our board, we are presenting for the first time in 56-year history of this organization, flexible models of budgets, not one budget to be approved, but three. We are innovating inside, along with how we start looking at what needs to happen for the future with staff, about how we can be nimble and flexible, not just for the plays. I mean, the plays for me are the vehicle for the community. You know, the plays are the vehicle for us to be a citizenry together. So we are trying to come up with innovative models to be nimble to what's going to happen next. And part of that is just because I got sick and tired, like I'm sure you all did and our audience out there, of making a series of decisions and then change them. And then making a series of decisions and having to pivot again. And so now I'm giving myself permission to get through this budget cycle, have these flexible models approved, look at the different models of the season, and activate digital platforms that we can, and also look at this thing that's a year out and try to manage the great pain in this country, being a good partner and dad, you know, and learning. So that's where we're at.
Well, David, I know you have to go, but before you go, I just want to say that kind of clear, flexible thinking is success. So I will use the word again and say, you're doing a hugely successful job. And if you have to disappear now for a minute, that's
2 minutes. I'll be right back.
No worries. I think almost everybody, I didn't track it specifically, but almost everybody at one point used the word community, talked about connecting to the community. And I always believed that that was incredibly important. There was a time, I think, when artistic directors would go and sit in fancy offices and never really talk to their talk to their community, certainly never go out into the community. I used to spend a lot of time standing in the middle of the lobby before and after the show, good and bad, ready to take it one way or the other. Just because I thought that that was an effective way to get to know the audience. So how are you, Melia, you talked a little bit about this, but let's talk more about how you're managing or trying to connect to your audience during this period when contact is so hard. And Sarah and Tim, how are you managing to introduce yourself to your audiences? Sarah, you want to go first?
I think something that's come up in a lot of our conversations is again, that so much of our dialogue right now is over virtual platforms, and that is just how it is right now. But we've been talking a lot about how do we center that in a way that feels conversational and like dialogue and not lecture. And I think that's something that's really at the heart of how we're thinking about sort of our digital platforms or our socially distant in-person offerings right now, of how can we be in conversation with our audience. And especially it's important to me to get to learn what does our audience crave in this time? What are they thinking about? What audiences have we not been speaking to? I'm certainly learning a lot from staff members right now and listening to who hasn't been in conversation with the theater that we want to bring into conversation. So I think for me, I really appreciate what others have said about the digital medium, and it can feel like we're pushing something out, but trying to think of that as a way that we engage in conversation and dialogue. I also think that in this moment, it's really important to think about, for me, and this is very early days, right? But these conversations we're having internally around the great gift of the We See You document, around Black Lives Matter, around the work that our staff is so engaged and has such an appetite for, how are we having those conversations with our audience and giving them an opportunity to share in that in-process dialogue about where we are, where we're headed, where we want to be headed, what the community has dealt with in the past. And so that's something that's really at the forefront of the planning that I'm doing, is how do we get in conversation with people as much as possible, as safely as possible.
Tim, you want to weigh in on that?
Yeah, I can. I mean, as much as I'm not loving living in the world of Zoom, we've embraced digital platforms and content as a way to keep connected to our audience. And it's not a great substitute for me in my molecular way, but it is, I think it is making some connections. And so we've just launched a couple new programs and are about to launch one called Voices of Democracy, which is really about getting out the vote, and it's about dealing with racial justice and equality. And so we'll have some poetry readings and giving some actors in our area opportunities to make a little cash and to keep their instrument going and to keep their civic voice engaged. We're doing new work development still. We have a very strong new work project that is ongoing here. And so we've got some play readings that we've done and some more that are coming up, and opportunities for our audience to give us response to that work. So we keep that muscle going and that open. Just last week I had someone with a camera from our office socially distanced over in my backyard, and I was at the barbecue and just chatting some with my audience about wishing that I could have them over for barbecue, and how theaters like you make the barbecue and all the flavors meld together, then you have to cook it low and slow, and then finally you crisp it up at the end, and everyone comes and enjoys it, and just trying to recreate that feeling of community and connection that I'm looking forward to making. So, we're doing those sorts of things. We tomorrow we're involved with Women's Equality Day, and we did something around the centennial last week, and we're working with the League of Women's Voters, 14 different groups from around the nation. So the one thing I'll say about the digital platform that's exciting is the ability to actually transcend our geography and connect more with groups throughout the nation, as well as working in our case with the Palo Alto Women's Club here. That is a very old club that is sort of connected to League of Women's Voters and making that connection. So we're finding a lot of interesting ways, and maybe some ways that will continue on for us and how we look to make community connection, even when we're not able to physically be in contact with each other. But I still rail against the the feeling of being disconnected physically, but I am embracing it at the same time. And it's this thing with, Sarah was saying earlier, you got all these plates in the air. It's like I have dual feelings about all of those things, but we're definitely in that world now.
Tim, you've been both informative and you've made us all very hungry now with your remark. I will be there for it. I'll be up shortly.
So. Come on over. We have fires burning just up the hill here. I can just take the ribs. Easy to smoke and cook all at once. You know?
That was a perfect description of barbecue. Really good barbecue.
Good.
It was.
Really good.
Oh, yeah. I'll come to Houston and bring you some barbecue. Wow, come on.
I'm inspired. I make brisket, but it's not.
Brisket is great.
Jewish-y, Sephardic brisket, you know, so.
I do Texas-style brisket, but, you know, I've perfected it. And the weird thing is I'm a vegan, so I don't actually eat it, but I will cook it for others.
We are coming over.
I'm ready to do it anytime.
We are, but we digress. Rob, you talked a little bit about succeeding a very, very long-term artistic director, somebody who'd been there many, many decades, actually, mm-hmm. and somebody very, very different personality than you. So a year is not really enough time to connect with the community and let them know who you are and what your ideas are about running the theater. So are you doing anything now to overcome that challenge during the pandemic?
Yeah. Well, we've got an amazing department, education and community engagement, and they've been putting out, we've actually made one of our rehearsal halls a recording studio, a TV studio, that we can do some socially distanced recording in. And they've just been putting out tons and tons of great stuff, a lot of it bilingual. It's all on our website for Allie at Home and Fun at Home for Kids. And so that has been great. And then in our department, when we shut down, it was the day after we had opened 1984, and we got a concession to film it and put it out for a week. And our general manager, Brandon Kahn, he wrote his thesis at Columbia on the decision of the NFL to start televising games, which it's hard to imagine, but at the time, it was really controversial because people thought you're going to parasitize, you know, your ticket sales for the stadium. Why would people come to the stadium if they could just watch it at home? And of course, what they found out was the exact opposite. You were able to get more fans. There was more access. You didn't have to pay for an expensive stadium seat. You could watch it at home. And that's a lot of what we found with 1984. We had people, you know, it wasn't just our small downtown area. People, a wider group of Houston got to tune in. I think all states but two. There are only two states that didn't have viewers. And then there were viewers in Brazil, viewers in Germany, viewers in England. We got a review in the Wall Street Journal that we would have never gotten had we not, you know, filmed it. And of course, when Hamilton came out on Disney Plus, you know, all of a sudden, all these people who couldn't have afforded Hamilton tickets all of a sudden have access to Hamilton. And so I agree with everybody here about, you know, I did not decide to go to LA and be a film person or a TV person. I love the live experience. I live for the live experience. But I do feel like when a show is filmed really well, it can be a great experience of its own. It's not the same, but it can provide access to people, you know, people who are parents and they just can't get a sitter that night. You know, it means that
there's a babysitting program.
Yeah. So you know, you can. So I'm really hoping that this becomes more the norm. And I mean, one of the things we're considering when we do reopen, depending on where we are with the pandemic, is having the shows, you know, socially distanced, the audience socially distanced. And then also filmed, so audiences during this time that it's not clear how safe it is, audiences who are vulnerable can decide, you know what, I'm going to stay home and watch it. I'll wait until the numbers go down before I feel comfortable coming to the theater. And people who feel like, oh, I you know, if as long as I'm wearing my mask and I'm socially distanced, I'll be fine. So people have a choice. So even. Even with that, we're starting to consider what would a world look like where you have the option of seeing it live or being in person. So that's a future I hope we see.
Great, thanks, Rob. So let's talk about race. And I am pleased that I saw nobody's shoulders go up tightly when I said that. I was Tim and I and Sarah. And maybe some of the others of you, I was on a call with about 45 theaters, 45 LORT theaters a couple of weeks ago. And at one point I saw all these shoulders lifted like this, talking about all the problems of racial equality in their theaters and how they were going to be affected, the problems of the demands from the We See You White America. And I said at one point, Why don't we stop talking about this as if it's a problem and talk about the opportunities that finally having this conversation in a forthright, direct, and honest way gives us. And I do think that it gives us great, great opportunities. I think I said, you know, at one point everybody thought integration was a problem. Segregation was the problem, integration was the solution. So maybe we can start thinking of it that way. But I know that there are many people watching today who want to hear your thoughts about this. And I'm particularly interested in how the demands and the conversation is affecting, obviously, your audiences, your staff training, and all of that. But how is it affecting your artistic thinking as you begin to think forward into the upcoming season and beyond? David, I'll start with you.
Thank you, and forgive the brief hiatus. I'm glad this is part of this discussion today. I think it should be part of every discussion, along with our flexible budgets and our season programming and our conservatory programs and our dwindling staff. I think the We See You White American Theater document is one of the most extraordinary, complete, and sort of immediate documents I've read. I think if you were a leader in any sector and you received a document that complete and thorough from your departments, from anybody that you received it from, you would be paying attention. Our theater, and I'm still in a deep learning phase of the internal workings of the theater and the history and the forward legacy of the theater, I think is
in an immediate internal, that word thoughtful comes back to mind, patient and thoughtful analysis of who we are as it relates to racism, as it relates to our infrastructure, things that I think I am not and many others are not even aware of that affect and deeply affect the community that surrounds us. So we have, how should I say this, interviewed consulting firms. And I'm really happy to say that in Southern California, Sheldon, you may know this, these firms that are there to help us with racist training and some HR training are backed up. I mean, we're in a line. I'm proud to say that we're about to get a proposal from the company that we think we really want to work with, and our systems are going to go into place here pretty quick. We're going to do that internal work. And frankly, we're going to continue on the trajectory of the work that was already moved into place about the artists that are represented in our work and the communities, which I dare say are not the same for every person. You know, we're surrounded by a huge Latinx community. We're surrounded by a huge Asian community. Orange County is less than 2% of a Black population. But all of our work, on stage, off stage, and in our staffing, this is the opportunity right now. We actually have the time, as everyone said, to say, great, how is this going to affect how we look at now restaffing the theater? How is it going to look at how we continue to do the hard work in our programming? I don't believe as an artistic director that the answer is in, you know, we do a bunch of plays that reflect a wide variety of citizenry and that's enough. I think we are a cultural institution that has to connect the dots continuously. And we have to have a deep, long bench commitment. And I've always felt that way, and I'm excited by the opportunity to continue that work. I don't believe in virtual signaling. I have said it is imperative that the work becomes dimensional. We can talk about it and we should talk about it, but the ultimate goal is to have other people talk about what an example we are and not ourselves. So if we could be in a position where we are presenting in a way and our work is representative of where we live and who we serve and other people can notice and have access and partake, terrific. That said, I am proud of much of the work that we've started at South Coast Rep. I am proud of any of the artists that are connected before my tenure. And I think there's a ton of work to go forward. And I am glad we have several documents to help keep our awareness focused and help us learn how to move forward. So, you know, opportunity abounds. There's a lot of silver linings, which I didn't talk about in my earlier depression about COVID. And I just will say this because I think I don't know if it's the same with you. One of them, honestly, that I never anticipated is I don't know that I've had so many weekends strung together where I've not been at a theater, either in a lobby or, you know, making curtain speech or checking in or going, oh my gosh, there's a leak in the bathroom or whatever it is. So even the weekend time to process, which is powerful, to marinate in a document or not read a play, but think about some of the other things that I've read during the week. Even though as hard as it is, Melia, to digest the news, being able to step away on a weekend or a couple of days, that's taught me something about what we're going to be looking at in terms of process and how we work. Because the reflection time, even learning through my children, and then wanting to represent the world as they have to see it, and that I have an opportunity as an artistic director for those kids helping to run a cultural institution to see the world and experience the world as it really is incredibly powerful. I'll stop, but thank you.
Very successful thinking again, David. Thank you. Melia, I know you've been very on the cutting edge about this, even in your short time at the theater, but do you have thoughts or comments about how to take this subject forward?
I don't feel worthy, but I really appreciate the...
Well, I think so.
I think I echo very much what David has said. I mean, whatever we think our own trajectory and our work has been and whatever we've put forth and the kind of work we've done as individual artists, it is a really different thing to then helm an institution and try to think about how to make structural change. So there's no question that in the pain of letting folks go, there's also the opportunity to rebuild in a different way. I think about EDI training and it breaks my heart that we're such a small staff to do it right now. We're doing it, we have a consultant working with the board, and we as a senior staff, one day a week, we meet every morning on Zoom, and one day a week we devote now to going through the We See You White American Theater document and discussing different points and trying to highlight, you know, which are the items that are really under our control. Because I think this is what I find sort of extraordinary about this document, is that you can read it as a great sort of manifesto of aspirational vision, but you can also then go through and see, okay, what are work rules we control? What is a union issue and what is actually a management issue? Do you know? And how do we change our point of view as the senior staff? We've also, because I was such a dark voice on Zoom, I need to assert all the good things Hartford Stage is trying to do in this way as well. The good thing about Zoom is intimacy. There is an intimacy to this platform that's kind of surprising. I mean, look at all of us, we're in each other's rooms, right? So we've been doing education programs online, which have been revelatory, because you see all the inner city high school kids that we're working with and the elementary school kids, we see everyone in their bedrooms or their dining room, and you see parents in the background. So there's a way of kind of viewing the mission of what community is and what the theater needs to reflect matched with who's coming through these systems with us, right? And these, I keep pointing to my laptop. That's what this gesture is. I'm sorry. I keep going, this machine that now controls my life. I also think what's really been, and I'm with you, David, weekends are a new thing. I think for many of us, like, you know, who knew that some people like don't go to work on the, even like coming to the dining room to work instead of leaving the house. But, figuring out how to absorb this document and think about the national concern and then translate it into what the local needs are. So this is really, I think that for me, just as an individual, I think some folks on my staff are much better thinking nationally. I'm trying to digest and translate and transform the what those principles are, what the demands are, to see what actually, what works in my community? And what are these are questions, problems, challenges, opportunities in the greater Hartford region that our education programming or our library partnership or, you know, we're doing, not unlike you, Tim, we're doing a suffragists outdoor event to sort of remind people, because sexism is still out there, anti-Semitism is still out there. How do we contain all, not contain, but amplify the voices from this document into these different communities and translate them into a way that really makes the theater work towards equity for all. So there's a lot of ruminating and rereading and discussing at our institution. We haven't had as much of a chance to actively discuss it with our audience per se, but what it has done, and Sheldon, you talked about sort of season planning and thinking about work. I mentioned my, what we call seen and heards, with a pun on scene, which is the weekly, now monthly program. And that document really helped shift the focus of those. And they're all recorded on our website. And the first few were very industry heavy, favorite actors, favorite designers, a production meeting, a design conversation. And then more and more, they moved to community partnerships. And to, you know, for Father's Day, we did Black Dads in our community who had storytelling a la Moth, And we had we partnered with two community organizations to tell those stories. And I think my filter personally shifted much more towards how to show off my community and highlight them and bring them into the theater. And I think it's really this movement that has amplified that sense and really.
I think you make a very good point, and it mirrors the larger conversation. You know, people of color are not a monolith, and the American theater is not a monolith. There are different challenges and opportunities in every city in America. Rob, I know Houston well, having been there years ago and then recently at Theater Under the Stars. And I can see that you might have some specific challenges in this area in parts of Houston. And again, Houston is not monolithic. There's certain aspects of Houston that are incredibly, you know, liberal and forward-thinking and all of that. But can you talk about your specific opportunities and challenges in Houston?
Absolutely. I mean, Houston's such a cool city. And has you know, it's the fourth largest city in America. It's, you know, the New York Times called it the most diverse city in America. So you know, that's a big opportunity. And our founder, Nina Vance, when she started the theater, she sent out little penny postcards and said, "Houston, this is your theater." And I kind of keep going back to that sentence as kind of our little founding, you know. It's almost like our Declaration of Independence or something, you know. It's something I keep going back to of what does it mean to be Houston's theater, you know, for this community. And in my first year, I was able to do a lot of stuff on stage, and the benefit of this time and the We See You document is to really be able to do the internal work with the staff, so that it's owned by everyone. Also, you know, I just, something maybe an elephant in the room, but we were just called out as a theater not responding to the We See You document, and we did respond on July 28th, and then. I, you know, everybody, and I shared it with the board and with the staff and my response, and everybody yesterday was really surprised that we were called out as not responding. And I said, well, don't worry, I'll write back. And they got it the second time. But anyway, I just say that as, you know, cause I don't want people to think that the alley isn't taking the We See You document seriously. We are, the entire organization is working on the document. And we made a list of, even before the document came out, because we made a statement for Black Lives Matter, we felt like, you know, when we made that statement, we immediately said, we can't just make a statement and not have actions to back it up. So we made 7 commitments of things that the alley is going to do to back up the statement and to be the kind of theater that we want it to be. One of the big ones is, because we're rooted in an acting company, is expanding that company and bringing more diversity to the acting company. And that's something I'm very excited about. And it's something that's gonna happen as soon as we come back from COVID. The challenge is going from San Francisco, right, to Houston. In San Francisco, you're pretty much guaranteed that everybody's going to agree with you. It's very, you know, the opinions are very similar, right? It's really, I was actually telling my mom the other day, it's very possible to live in San Francisco and not talk to a Republican in 5 years, right? That's not possible in Houston. You're going to talk to a Republican every day. You know, there's a much bigger, you know, the city's very liberal, but it's in Texas, and there's a wide range of opinions and thoughts and cultures, besides the fact that it's diverse just because of what it is, because it's the center of the medical industry and the energy industry. there are people from all over the world who moved to Houston to live there. So they're all different languages, all different cultures. And you can't assume that whoever you're talking to is going to agree with you. And I think that's kind of a wonderful thing, because that's what theater should be about. It should be about people with many different perspectives, seeing experiences, you know, just a play in general. Once you have three people on stage, you've got three different ideas of the world, three different perspectives, and you get to watch them work that out. And so that's, you know, so rooting it all in the work is the opportunity that I think, you know, so the challenge is, how do we move the theater forward with everybody coming along with us? The board, the artists, the staff, right? How do we move in a direction that everybody owns, everybody feels good about? And that thing I said about the three different perspectives on the stage, I've always been trying to root it in the work we're doing, and that our art form is about listening to people who disagree with us, who we may be offended by, we may not like, but we watch the characters work it out, and we get to kind of reflect and go off and think about, well, what, you know, we saw those different perspectives, where do we sit? How do we think? You know, how do we talk about that? So rooting all this in our art form is kind of how I'm trying to get the ball moving forward.
Thank you, Rob. Tim or Sarah, we're about to come to the end of our time, but anything you two want to add to this part of the conversation? Tim?
I'll just say, I was, you know, I think this is a tipping point in this country, and I'm hopeful that it is. It feels like it to me. I grew up in the civil rights era. I was around when Martin Luther King was assassinated, and through that whole period, and I remember the efforts that were going on. And I think the WCU White American Theater document is extraordinary. I think it's really important. I think it's going to become a major catalyst for change in the American theater, a change that I've been spending the last 35 years of my career working towards. I remember at TCG back in the day, you know, there were six or eight of us under a tree at Smith College back in the 80s, and we would break off every once in a while and have what we call the little caucus of artists of color. We were the only ones of the entire conference at that time. And then we would bring forward a paper and one of us would read it out at some point on day three or four when they were longer conferences, and people would listen, and then, you know, things would just keep moving on. And anyway, long story short, I feel like this is giving cover to many of us who have had our necks out there for a very long time. And I'm appreciative of that effort. I'm appreciative of my colleagues around the American theater that are truly listening in a different way and beginning to take real palpable action towards anti-racism. I think, you know, just saying I'm not racist isn't enough. We need to be anti-racist if we're going to make a difference. And I, you know, my mentor, I got a shout out to, Ruben Sierra, who really taught me to be an artistic director when I was just coming out of the University of Washington. You know, that company formed as a reaction to feeling there was systemic racism and they didn't have opportunities to get on stage or to have a voice. And so I feel like giving a voice and a platform for all of our citizens in an equal way is the responsibility if we're taking tax money from wherever we are, and if we're truly trying to live out the experiment that America says it wants to be as a democracy. So I'm excited about what I hope will happen from this, and the lens through which I have always seen this and through which I'm trying to guide our entire staff and will eventually with our board and audience, is to look at this through an anti-racist lens and a truly multicultural lens, and not only a token here and there. So that's what I would just add.
Thanks, Tim. That's wonderful. And Sarah?
Amen to Tim Bond. I feel like I know we're at time and we should leave with Tim's amazing words and work. But being new, I feel two things at once. I feel great urgency to action and to respond. And I also feel a lot of humility around the need to listen and for primarily white institutions and leaders to listen and embody these conversations right now. So I'm grateful for this time. I hope to continue these conversations with all of you, but I'd like to end with what Tim said.
Well, I'm going to end it with what James Baldwin said, which is, I have very little interest in what you say you're going to do and a great deal of active interest in what you actually do. And thank you all for doing what you're doing in this area and in all areas. We had one more question, which I'm going to turn into an offer. We had a question from Carrie Perloff, who was for decades artistic director at ACT in San Francisco, very successfully. And her question was, is there anything that somebody who's been in this game for a long time can do to help you or to be of assistance to you? So I am going to turn Carrie's very good question into an offer and have you bombard her with your questions based on her offer of help. And I'll also make the same offer myself. Finally, I just want to say that as one like Carrie, who knows how tough this job can be, how rewarding this job can be, I'm grateful to all of you for your bravery, for your courage, your passion, your burning intelligence, and your willingness to stick with it even when it's tough. It's always tough to do these jobs, perhaps never more tough than right now, but I have such admiration to all of you for your willingness to keep going and walking down that path. Thank you so much for that. And thanks to everybody who's joined us today. It's been great to have you here. These conversations are supported by the SDC Foundation. So if you're enjoying them and want to hear more of them, please go to the website. And if you have a dollar or $5 or whatever you can push out there, it's the way these things happen. That support is so important to the foundation. But thank you for being here, and be brave, be strong, stay well. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you. Sheldon, thank you for your
Sheldon.
Voice and moderating.
Thank you. Great to see you all.
Great to see everybody.
See you all.
Be safe.
Good to fight, y'all. See you soon.
Thanks, everybody. Bye-bye.